Welcome to the Team EF Coaching Performance Podcast, where we take information from the highest level of sport and make it accessible for all cyclists. I'm your host, Zach Morris, and in this episode, I'm going to be interviewing Dr. Jason Boynton, who has a PhD in exercise and sports science, as well as a master's in exercise physiology. What's interesting about Jason is, unlike most PhDs who choose a career path in more popular funded sectors like general health, Jason has committed his life to researching cycling and endurance sports performance since 2005. While most of you would imagine this anyway, it's nice to note that Jason is also a high-level master's rider in his own right. On today's episode, we'll be entering one of Jason's most well-researched domains on the effects of environmental temperature on cycling performance. Jason has recently joined the roster of coaches at Team EF Coaching, and we're thrilled to have him on our team. So, without any further ado, Dr. Boynton, welcome to the Team EF Coaching Performance Podcast.
Wow. Thanks, Zach. Thanks for having me, and thanks for bringing me on the roster with Team EF Coaching. I think it's a good professional move for me, and I'm happy to be a part of the group and having that kind of synergy with everybody else. Looking forward to all that moving forward. And thanks for the warm introduction. I guess the only thing I would add there is the coaching background too. Has been doing that for about 15 years, so. Yeah, I really like the idea of, you know, looking at science and then trying to figure out how to apply it in the real world with an outcome such as, you know, increasing the performance of athletes and kind of all those kind of creative workarounds and problem solving and stuff like that they have to come up with it to kind of come to those conclusions. So yeah, there's my little micro spiel there.
Well, I'm sure the audience will soon learn why we brought you on board. If you've never listened to any of Jason's podcasts before, he's been featured on several other podcasts. Jason is a wealth of knowledge. And one of the key reasons why I wanted to get Jason on Team EF Coaching is because he's interested in all levels of athletes. Of course, he wants to coach the top level of sport, pro athletes, and try to win big races. But he's also interested in helping people do their first cycling. And that to me makes Jason really special. So I want to get right into it. I've got a lot of questions for Jason. I'm sure we're all going to learn a lot on this episode today. I'd imagine this will be our most dense episode that we've done to date. My first question is, Jason, for the past few years, we've seen a bigger focus on cooling in the pro peloton. Like most things that get attention from the media in high performance, how to handle riding in the heat is on the top of mind for more athletes in the world than ever before. But before we dive into discussing the effects of heat, I wanted to ask you how we should be shaping our perspective around temperature in general and what the key things are that we need to consider as high performance athletes.
Oh, that's a good one. I think, first of all, just temperature in general, you have to consider it's a gradient, right? So when we talk about what is hot, well, what is hot? Is it hot like something as you're sweating as you're sitting there, or is hot somewhere where the performance starts to decrease? And even in the literature, when you look at the papers, there isn't like any one temperature that all the scientists have just decided to settle on to say this is hot. You know, 40 degrees Celsius, which is about 104 degrees Fahrenheit, or is it 35 or is it 30, right? So that will vary. But I think the good news is for high performance endurance athletes, they are excellent at dealing with heat and thermal stress as a starting point, right? And even if you aren't that athlete that is a high performing endurance athlete, you can rest assured that many of the things that you would naturally want or do to improve your performance will also improve your ability to handle heat, right? That's not to say that high performance athletes can't improve their ability to deal with heat any higher, But it is to say that they are have a really good starting point. And there's a couple of reasons for that. Now, so so first of all, like a high performing endurance athlete is going to have a low body fat. So that's going to help because there's, I guess, for a lack of insulation that's interfering with this heat transfer. So,
to interrupt you there for a second.
Yeah, yeah.
Body fat percentage would make your efficiency in heat worse if it was higher.
So that's one of the things that we kind of forget about, you know, being bigger. Like we think, oh, if I have a lot of fat mass, it's going to hurt my ability to climb. Yes. If I have a lot of fat mass, it's going to hurt my ability to accelerate. Yes. But it's also going to negatively affect your ability to thermal regulate. So you're going to be holding on to heat and banking up that kind of thermal heat waste, I guess, more. So getting back to, it's one of those things, like it's like this double-edged sword all throughout, right? So losing fat mass is greatly beneficial to performance. So it is something to focus on, which means diet and regular exercise and that kind of stuff, right? And along with that, that's related to that is basically the body composition, or I guess not necessarily composition, but the kind of phenotype of an endurance athlete. If we think of your stereotypical high performing endurance athlete, they're long and lean, right? They're not squat kind of, you know, tiny little rustler builds. No offense there, Zach, but they have that, like, basically what the best way to phrase it is they have a high surface to volume ratio, right? Like they have very little volume, but they have a lot of skin to lose that heat to. So that's another thing that is really valuable to them, losing heat to their environment, because that's what, at the end of the day, that's what you want. And the other thing is the high cardiovascular ability. If you think about your ability to lose heat is very similar to how a car works, that the heat that is produced in the engine is removed from it through a hydraulic system and brought out to a radiator, which then that radiator transmits that waste heat to the environment. So your cardiovascular function improves that ability to move that waste heat from the engine or the working muscles out to the skin, and hopefully with less detrimental effect, because that cardiovascular system is also transporting the fuel and oxygen to the working muscles. So there's a little bit of competition that goes on. I guess we'll get into that once we get into the physiology. Yeah,
break that down. Yeah. For me. The muscles are the engine. The cardiovascular system is what? What's the radiator and what is the skin? Connect those dots.
Okay. So if you think of the muscles as the engine where the heat would be generated, because when we exercise, only about 25% of that energy is actually going into powering or moving the muscle, when 75% of that is lost as heat. So as efficient as we are, we're still not very efficient. So that heat has to go somewhere. And the reason for that is because it has detrimental effects on the performance. So I can get into that a little bit later. But yeah, so the blood vessels would be like the tubes or the hoses that are leaving the engine. And then the skin is kind of like your radiator. But unlike the engine, those tubes and hoses also would be what's transmitting the fuel and the oxygen in the carb. I guess like it all analogies break down at some point, but hopefully that kind of relays the point, right?
I hope that connected the dots for everybody else who was also wondering.
Yeah. So it's important. The take home is high cardiovascular ability, better ability to thermoregulate, and especially under environmental challenges like heat. And then there's also an improved ability to sweat. And I think that's something that's kind of overlooked with endurance athletes is every time you go out and do a workout, you are exposing yourself to a thermal challenge. There's a massive overlap in physiological response acutely and adaptations between experiencing thermal stress and experiencing stress that is given to you through exercise. So a lot of the adaptations are really very similar between the two. If you heat acclimate, you're going to see an increase in plasma volume. If you exercise, you're going to see
just for the listeners, what does an increase in plasma volume do?
You have your blood is made up of, blood cells, red blood cells, white blood cells, and then you have the kind of serum or fluid, plasma that would move that. It would be the solution, that moves that around. So, you increase the amount of plasma, blood plasma that you would have through exercise, which increases stroke volume and cardiac output. So it's a very kind of quick and dirty way. It's one of the initial things that happens when you experience adaptations to exercise. And interesting enough, you have a greater increase in plasma volume, supposedly, from heat acclimation than you would just from exercise alone. But yeah, it's like when you are undergoing an exercise stress, you are also experiencing a thermal stress. So endurance athletes are already kind of on their way to becoming better at heat acclimation than, say, like a sedentary population or something. But yeah, like I said, it's just hard to separate those two things. And then there's the other kind of thing to think about too, is that you can just do the kind of thought experiment that there probably is some range of temperature that is optimal for endurance performance. Because if we get too hot, then obviously we're going to see a decrease in performance. And if we get too cold, we're going to see a decrease in performance. So there is actually research out there that has looked at where that kind of optimal area is. And a number of the papers out there, including some of my research, sit around 10 to 13 degrees, which there's obviously a lot of factors that come into like determining really what that is, but it probably sits a little bit lower than a lot of people would think. 10 to 13 degrees Celsius, which is going to be around 50 to 55 degrees Fahrenheit.
So the entire audience is wondering if they're going to be able to perform in the summer and trying to now move their A races to the spring classics. Don't worry, guys.
Don't worry. Yeah.
So just to summarize on a couple of points you made there, Jason, one of the key things we need to focus on is body composition in terms of body fat percentage, how prepared the body is. That's going to have a big impact on how you respond to hot weather, but does it also have the same impact for cold weather?
Oh, yeah, that's a long conversation there in terms of
you can give me the short version.
So it's when we exercise, we're already, like I said, increasing the core temperature. And so we're already on our way to heat acclimation because we're giving ourselves a heat stress. So if you're an endurance athlete, you kind of get two bangs for your buck because you can exercise and give yourself an environmental heat stress and improve your ability to deal with that, right? Well, in the textbook kind of approach to cold acclimation requires a drop in core temperature. So after you're doing your workout, are you going to go and sit in the cold room for like 50 minutes to an hour and a half just to get your cold acclimation in? And then arguably you could do some cold exposure during rides to get some benefits there maybe, but yeah, I guess we'll get into that a little bit more when we talk about cyclocross and stuff, but yeah.
Okay. So we've got body composition, we've got phenotype. And then the question I had to your point on phenotypes is if we look at cycling, for the most part, everybody's lean and mean and long, like you said. But we do have a few different phenotypes within the peloton, for example, bigger climbers and sprinters. Have you noticed any correlation between those phenotypes being more or less efficient in different weather circumstances?
I mean, if you were going to talk about, it gets into what is what actually a sprinter. Like, if we're talking about track sprinter, I would say, yeah, I would definitely look at a track sprinter. But if we're looking at, you know, a world tour sprinter, yeah, I wouldn't know because I don't think a lot of the world tour sprinters are determined in what we would necessarily say a quote unquote sprinter is, which gets into its own conversation. But I would say, I mean, my take on what the research is looking at right now, it's more about the sprinters that we see in the world tour or high level, or it's more about like fascicle length as opposed to type 2 fiber types and more about gross mechanical efficiency and things like that. So these athletes are still endurance athletes, even though we've decided to name them sprinters. So you could argue that maybe someone like, what was the big German sprinter?
Kittel?
Yeah, Kittel. Like, massive guy. Like, obviously, he's probably not going to thermal regulate as well as any of the GC riders. I would probably put money on it, but he's the extreme, right? So some of these other guys, yeah, but then there's probably other things that are probably affecting them more. So yes, I think the sprinters have a little bit more mass and that type of thing. So yes, but then we're kind of splitting hairs at some point. So
okay,
gets into a theory.
Okay. So body composition, we've got phenotype, which sounds like all cyclists, endurance cyclists are kind of in the same general category. And what else should we be considering?
Well, you could consider the level of heat acclimation that you have, which would come into sweat responses and cardiovascular.
Yeah. Right.
So
my question on the sweat was, would somebody who sweats more be better in hotter circumstances or less? Does that make sense to ask?
Yeah, and that is an interesting one too, because as you would heat acclimate, I think there's more kind of water retention, but also our sweat efficiency increases. So I think it's we are able to sweat more by excreting less sweat that we need, so that's good. And we get far better at sweating, and our sweat response is much quicker. I have some interesting anecdotes about that. Like, I participated in one of my colleagues' research experiments looking at pre-cooling, and it was mostly like healthy college kids or whatever, and I was like the outlier athlete in there, and my sweat response was just an outlier. It was like some crazy amount of sweat that I put out versus them. And then the other thing is like, I remember there's another anecdote. It was hot in Perth one day, and all of a sudden I had to run to the train, and I got on the train, and I just sat down, not breathing hard, but all of a sudden this sweat just gushed, right? Yeah. And so I'm just, all of a sudden the shirt is just wet and everything. I'm just like, all these people around me. I was like, oh God, this is the pain of being an athlete. And I knew that was partly because of just being, having that quick, fast sweat response that someone that isn't trained isn't necessarily going to have. But then you can maybe argue with that, that sweat response is going to have a negative effect, because you're losing water quicker. But, you know, a lot of the research around how the detriments on dehydration are actually a little bit off. So we can actually lose probably a little bit more water than what we used to think, because of the older experiments were probably experiencing high heat was probably the detriment that we were seeing after like 1% losses in hydration, as opposed to the actual dehydration being the cause of it. So yeah, a little fun fact there. So it's still important to hydrate, though, obviously. Hopefully that answers your question.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of information there, and I really would just like to do my best effort to try to make it super concise for everybody, because we try to make this podcast just accessible for everyone. So if you're coming in and you don't have a big science background, we want you to really be able to get it. So
you get me talking on it. I'll just keep going.
It's great.
It's good to have you here to like stop me and just translate. Like, what's this again? Yeah, it's good.
No, it's great. And so I just want to recap one more time. I'm sorry for the listeners that have already gotten it. Just for everybody. So we want to look at body composition. I think we've identified now that body composition, everybody, is really important. Whether you're riding in hot or cold temperatures, the leaner you are, the more efficient you're going to be. That was one take home I really took from that. And the second thing was that your phenotype can make a big difference. So if you're somebody new to cycling, let's say coming from the gym, lifting heavy weights, and now you're transitioning to cycling and picking it up as a new sport, sounds like you've got some work to do. To be able to, you know, become efficient at climate adaptation and adapting to different temperatures. And then the last part that I heard was the sweat rate. It's pretty important to build good efficiency in becoming a good sweater. And what determines that, Jason? What would make you a good sweater versus not a good sweater? Would it be your overall physical conditioning?
Honestly, I've never really thought about it, because it happens. And it's just like, if you exercise regularly and expose yourself to that thermal stress of exercise, you're going to start sweating better, right? It's just kind of one of those things that just kind of comes along with it. Like, it happens, and we have to know it happens, but it's kind of one of those things you just kind of keep in the back of your mind. Like, if you want it, it's not, like I said, going back to the high performing, you know, endurance athlete at the top of his game could still probably improve his sweat response with heat acclimation, but he probably has a better heat response than a sedentary individual or someone that's just mildly fit. Healthy fit, yeah.
So now that we have a basic understanding of how to look at temperature, be it before an event or a training ride, let's dive a bit deeper into the effects of heat. Most of us have seen some studies online that show us that extreme heat increases our heart rate and reduces our ability to produce our maximal sustained power outputs. Why is that? And what's happening here from a physiological perspective?
I guess to start out, it's complicated. When you really start, I always have to start out with that. When you dive into it, there's still a lot of debate in some of these areas. So it's always sound smart and say like it's multifactorial, because it is. But I guess we could start. I'd say you want to start at the molecular level first. And like I was saying, during exercise, we break down molecules from our food to release this energy to perform work. And like I said, 75% of that energy approximately is lost as heat. And this heat can have basically two effects. You know, during a warm-up, it can actually increase the rate of reactions that are occurring in the muscle. So increase the metabolism. So it's kind of like if you boil pasta, the pasta starts moving around. So imagine that. So the enzymes and things like that that need to work, need to transfer or need to cause reactions, actually kind of improve their ability just because there's a little bit of heat there and it's warming things up. However, on the other side of that, we have all those enzymes, our proteins, you know, enzymes are a type of protein. All of those kind of molecular machines that we have have different types of bonds, and some of those bonds are very lightly put together, like hydrogen bonds, and they are very pH and heat sensitive and chemical sensitive. So if it gets too hot, then those little micro machines, those little enzymes and catalysts and things like that, they start to denature and change their form. And in nature, form equals function. And so if you start changing their form, then you reduce their ability to function. So we have to, as you exercise and that heat gets stuck there, it will decrease your performance because you are not able to, you know, the muscles and everything like that are not able to function optimally. So there's this kind of happy spot for temperature in the muscle. So, all right, so we have this heat in the muscle that's kind of negatively affecting our performance. So what do we do from there? All right, well, we need to remove it. Like I said, it's like the car's radiator. You need to get that heat out of there. Otherwise, you're going to have some negative effects. So we pump blood through it. And while the blood comes through, yep, you're taking CO2 and all these other things out of the muscle and waste, other metabolites out of the muscles. You're also taking away this heat. And you take that heat out, and it eventually, you're trying to get it out to the environment. You're taking it to the skin. Right. And so that's a double-sided sword, or a double-edged sword, I guess. If you keep the heat in the muscle, you're losing performance. But as you need to remove more heat, you potentially have a cost on performance as well because of the cardiovascular cost. Because once the blood is oxygenated, comes back to the heart, that oxygenated blood can go to the muscle and help the working muscle, or it's still hot. So some of it's still hot, so you would divert it off to the skin. But unfortunately, it's not like the blood goes from the heart to the skin to the muscle and then back. It has to make a choice. So you start losing more of this heat to the skin, but that also means less oxygen is going to be delivered to the muscle for the heart rate that you have. This gets into cardiovascular drift and things like that. So as the environment gets hotter, it's harder to offload that waste heat to the environment because of that gradient. Like if there's a bigger difference in temperature between the environment and your skin, you're obviously going to be able to offload more of that temperature and that waste to the environment. But this is where it gets tricky, right? Does that kind of all make sense to you so far?
I'm following you. The noodle example really made sense to me. That was good.
Example for you, though.
Go ahead.
Another food example, like, is good to use is think about like eggs. When you crack an egg and you put it down, that yolk is clear. As soon as you put heat to it, right, it turns it into that white, right? And that is exactly what's happening in your muscle. If it gets too hot, it changes. It changes into a solid. You know, you're basically turning that egg, and you don't want that to happen. So the body will either reduce your ability to exercise so it's not overcooking itself, but it also is removing that heat, and that heat, the system to remove the heat has a negative effect on performance as well. So
did you say that? Let me just recap one thing here. So this, what Jason just described, is an internal process, not necessarily affected by external factors. So one of the things I think you said at the end was if the external temperature was cooler than the temperature on the skin, then it would be more efficient. Your body would be more efficient at running this cooling cycle. Did I get that correct? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that comes down to that optimal temperature for performance, right? Because if it's too cold, then you're cooling down the body to where it's not functioning as well. But if it's too hot, then you're not able to offload that heat energy to the environment, and the muscle starts getting too hot to perform well, right?
I know you said there's conflicting.
I'm talking a lot about the muscle, but there's a lot. I don't want people to think just about the muscle. You can think about the brain's getting hot, the gut's getting hot. So it's not just there, but a lot of times we kind of focus on that because cardiovascular system is very, very important to exercise, but it is a holistic thing, right? There's many pathways that heat can kind of be detrimental
But yeah, we talk a lot about the cardiovascular system when we're talking about thermoregulation.
Is one more dominant than the other in terms of producing heat?
I mean, in terms of being negatively affected by heat?
Yes.
Yeah, I would have to do a little bit of a deep dive on that to be quite honest. But I think if you were going to talk to someone like, I forget his first name, but Dr. Swaka, I think he would probably, his argument would be the cardiovascular system has a big effect on it. But what's interesting is, you know, if that is true, it would probably take a little bit to see that decrease in performance, because it takes a little bit of time just for that blood to start getting shunted out to the skin. But there is some research out of Coyle's lab that has demonstrated that basically as soon as you heat up the skin, as soon as the skin starts feeling heat and experiencing heat, you start getting tachycardia, which your heart rate will increase, and from that you reduce your stroke volume. So it's could be a lot more instantaneous than this whole process of the thermoregulation that comes in, which is again very, very deep physiology that I read a while ago, but it's not exactly coming back right now. So if someone has deeper questions on that, I'd have to like start looking things up. Yeah.
Well, I'm sure we can all put the, you know, common thought together that if our legs go from fluid egg whites to solid egg whites, it's probably not going to be a good thing for, you know, riding climbs.
Not that
fast.
Extreme, but like not that extreme, but you know, you'd be dead way before that happened. But yeah, you think about it like at the molecular level, when these things are just starting to get tweaked, it just takes small tweaks before they just start not functioning as optimally. So yeah.
Okay. So what are some of the things that we can do to mitigate the negative effects of the environmental heat on our performance?
Oh, I think there's a lot. I mean, I'm probably going to miss some. So I apologize ahead, but like, I mean, there's going to be behavioral things you could do, and then there's going to be adaptive physiological things that can happen. So heat acclimation is going to be a big one, I think. And that gets into it could be a podcast in itself of how that happens, but just like a basic overview of how heat acclimation occurs. It can happen during exercise. You can expose yourself to heat during exercise. I also point out that there's a difference between heat acclimation and heat acclimatization. So heat acclimating is something that's going to be artificial, and heat acclimatization is going to be something that happens within nature or naturally. So if you are riding outside and getting hot rides in, and you're seeing rises in core temperature during those, that is going to be heat acclimatization. So you could have a hybrid approach to this, you know. Yeah. And so heat acclimation, unlike exercise training, is very, very quick. So we see cardiovascular improvements, probably are the first things that happen. Again, with increases in plasma volume are almost as easy as water retention, and then adding some proteins and things like that to that solution. So that happens quickly. A lot of the cardiovascular stuff happens quickly. 14 days and a little bit farther out, that's when we start to see the pseudomotor, or the sweat responses are starting to improve. Now, there's new research that's coming out now that has looked at long response long adaptations to heat acclimation, because the hypothesis was, okay, so we see this increase in blood volume from the increase in plasma volume. We see this increase in plasma volume. Shouldn't that be followed up with an increase in hematocrit and red blood cells? And they've actually shown that now with long protocols, that the hematocrit will increase from continuous heat acclimation. Now, does that really have to translate into performance? That's a conversation, I think. But it is really interesting to kind of see that when we extend that even longer, we can see potentially increases in hematocrit and red blood cells. So heat acclimation is good. You want to do it if you know your event's going to be hot. How you want to approach that could be many different routes, from like a sauna to riding in the heat, riding indoors in a hot room, doing hot baths. There's a lot of different ways. You can talk about optimization of that, all that kind of stuff. The important thing, I think, that take home for the athlete that thinks or wants to heat acclimate to improve their performance is that the idea that it is added stress to, so it's not like it can be just dumped in there and you don't have to consider like what it does to your body, because again, it's added stress. And I guess if you want to talk about some of the benefits of heat acclimatization, there's research that came out, you know, over 14 days, they had riders riding on the heat every day. And by the end of the 14th day, the riders were not quite, but almost able to ride time trial as fast as they could in like a thermal neutral condition.
Yeah.
So like I said, it happens relatively quickly. And like anything, there's going to be diminishing returns over time. The important thing is just to try to work it in if you know your event's going to be hot.
So would the acclimatization be less stress on the system than the acclimation approach?
Probably less stress on your lifestyle.
Okay.
Because you don't have to like set all this other stuff up. But I mean, if you're going to ride outdoors for 5 hours or something like that, you know, there's potentially a diminishing return on that. Like, did you really need to be outside for 5 hours in the heat to get the benefit? Is, you know, that's a cool question right there. But yeah, so these, you know, the important thing I think for athletes is that it does improve performance in the heat. It is, and as you do it, the benefits, the just doing one or two sessions. There's a lot of research actually about micro or short-term heat acclimation of just like 4 to 5 sessions, and they show benefits there.
And, so, and the most common things for that are going in the sauna, going in the hot tub, doing protocols.
I make the argument that if you are exercising, then the best way to get the heat acclimation is to exercise in the heat.
Okay.
But if you can't make it to heat, if you can't, right, just like if you're going to a hot, humid environment, it's going to be better to exercise in a hot, humid environment before you go to the hot, humid environment, as opposed to a dry heat. However, it's still going to be better to hop into sauna or hop into a hot bath. That's going to be better than doing nothing or just endurance exercise. And I'll probably just drop in an anecdote here about kind of management of stress, just personally from heat acclimating myself. I was piloting out a study, and during that study I did pre and post exercise in the heat, and then in between that I did 5 sauna sessions, and I wanted these little portable saunas, and I saw an improvement in my physiological response and RPE before and after that, in that pre and post.
Over how many days?
I think it was over the course of a week, but like, you know, I only got certain week or 10 days or something like that. However, like I was pretty religious about tracking my training load and watching it, the PMC model and things like that. And one thing I noted was, you know, my TSB and how I felt were way off. My TSB, my training stress balance, my freshness from that model tracks pretty well with reality, and for me. And then I knew as soon as I started implementing this heat stress, all that was out the window.
Yeah.
And And one of the things is that changed how we direct the direction of that study, because initially we were trying to optimize intervals, optimize the temperature and training, almost like instead of polarizing training, we were trying to figure out where to add heat to optimize training responses. And that was for temperate conditions, like not hot, right? So when I got through that protocol, I just remembered how fatigued I felt. Just from the sauna sessions and the training. And I thought, well, I feel as fatigued as if I would have just done 3 days in a row of intervals. So which, you know, three days in a row of intervals versus heat acclimation. Well, specificity says that the intervals probably would have had a bigger benefit, right? It's a lot of anecdote and stuff like that, but like that was kind of what crushed that part of the training. We just said, nah, we're just going to see how environmental temperature affects intervals themselves without kind of heat acclimating these athletes before they come into the interval protocol. So,
fascinating. Yeah. So we've got a heat acclimation protocol that may be something, you know, we can definitely do that will help us, you know, increase our performance in these extreme conditions. Is there anything else we could do?
Yes, still more things like behavioral things.
Okay.
So there's pre-cooling and hydration and that type of thing. So you see people using the cooling vests and things like that. Like I'd honestly have to do a little bit more deep diving to see how effective they are. But a lot of the slushy stuff, there's a lot of research around that. That's probably only effective in the heat, and it's got to be really cool. Important that you're not just consuming a cold drink, you actually have to consume the ice chunks, because the important thing there is the phase change. That's where that's the very energy hungry part of
Hold on, you would do this before you trade or during or when?
So before you would do a hot race, yeah, you would consume slushies. There's a lot of research that the Australian Institute of Sport has done around this, and they've
Would the ice gels do the trick?
Nah, like think about going into and getting a slushy out of the slushy machine at the...
Okay.
Right? So it's kind of, you know, out of the convenience store or whatever, you know, that's got ice in it, but it's drinkable, right? So the important thing is that the ice in it is in it, because that's, like I said, that will suck out a lot of the heat energy as it phase changes into water, right?
Okay.
Liquid water, right? So that can do that. The benefits of that are short. I forget how long exactly. I think it's 20, 30 minutes or something like that. So if you're drinking slushy for like a 40K time trial, it'll eventually wear off, but then the benefits are there for the first part of it. So yeah.
Worth it. Definitely worth it.
Someone's going to do it. I've never tried it. You know, you'd probably want to try it before you were coming up to the state championships or whatever, and, you know, find out that whatever it is in the slushy doesn't really work in your gut well or something like that. You know, right?
Do you know, like, what kind of benefit that might add? How much of a benefit?
Not off the top of my head.
Okay.
So, again, this is actually interesting. Like I said, I went through one of these studies with my colleague Kester Chu, and so she also came up with a meta-analysis looking at a lot of the studies that were looking at pre-cooling and pre-cooling approaches. So in her study, we did a slushy, we did an ice bath before, or like a cool bath before, and then I can't remember what the... If there was another intervention in there off the top of my head. Like, we were trying these different approaches. It was interesting. I would definitely recommend someone looking up her research and all the others and the other people that are researching around it. Because, again, it comes there. I always quote Thomas Sowell, there are no solutions in life, only trade-offs. So when it comes down to those trade-offs, you know, a lot of times it's going to be the coach and the athlete that has to decide what those trade-offs are going to be. So I will tell you what doesn't work, in my opinion.
Okay.
Right. Okay. You ready for this? Controversial, factually based opinion. I think cooling base layers are stupid. I think they are stupid.
I agree, man. I had one in my fridge for, I think, 3 years. I tried it on one time and I was like, this is so
well,
stupid.
Well, no, not even the ones that like you cool, but like the ones that like they're just fabric that you just put on.
And yep.
And you ever watch people in group rides or whatever, they're the first ones on a hot day to open up their jersey. And like, why are you, it boggles my mind. And I actually have a meme for this. There's a meme for this on my Twitter that one of my mates made for me when I told them the idea. Thanks, Ollie. But so basically, you ever seen those memes with like the what is it? Is it Doge dog or Doge dog?
I haven't seen it.
So there's like the little weak Doge dog, and then there's the big buff Doge dog.
Okay. Oh yeah, I've seen like, that one.
Yeah. So in the past, humans, you know, when we are cold, put more clothes on. When we are hot, take clothes off. Right? And then the little weak Doge dog or whatever. Hopefully I'm not pronouncing that wrong. But yeah, modern cyclists puts on more layers when hot.
Yeah.
So
I agree. Anyways. I absolutely agree with you. So we've got climate, acclimation training, intervals in the heat or getting into a sauna, drinking slushies.
So you have to be careful with that. Be careful with the intervals in the heat. Like that's one of the things is what intensity are we going to exercise at? Well, we are exercising in the heat. So you have to realize that like my protocol was not for heat acclimation. It was looking at how heat affects intervals. So there are a couple studies that I could point to that they tried to do heat acclimation day after day after day using high intensity intervals as the exercise protocol while they were exposing the athletes to heat. And I would say both of them saw detrimental effects. So be really careful, right? Like you don't want to overdo it. So this real standard protocol is the Lorenzo protocol, which is like 2x45, 2x45 minutes at, I'd say like endurance pace. So like mid zone 2 or whatever. And, I think it's like 40 degrees Celsius, 35 degrees Celsius, somewhere in there. So that's a pretty standard heat acclimation protocol. But again, you don't have to do that. Like almost, and I think a lot of pros, like we've talked to Luke Plapp before about like what his approach was, and you know he just has to take a hot bath. He's really into the heat acclimation, and look, he's 2-time Australian champion, road national champion. I mean, that's kind of a post hoc observation, but that's a very very hot race. It's a very very tough race, and I would say like any athlete I'd have going to that race, I'd be like, we have to be looking at heat acclimation, right? So anyways, those are my thoughts on that, I guess.
Any other things we can do to mitigate the negative effects on the heat?
Maybe besides just being fit and heat acclimated and different behavioral things, like obviously, you know, try to stay cool before the race and hydrated and things like that. You know, just don't do silly stuff sitting out in the sun before your race. I mean, yeah, I'm probably forgetting some things, but yeah, those are the big things, I think.
So you mentioned slushies, which is kind of sounds like it parlays into my next question. What about some of these quick fixes that we're seeing becoming increasingly popular? For example, Dr. Craig Heller talks about the massive benefits of his cooling mitts. His claims go as far as saying that his mitts that cool through AVAs, the parts of your body with no hair, like your palms, parts of your face, and the soles of your feet, can be more effective. So these mitts that cool your body can be more effective than anabolic steroids. Solutions like this seem increasingly appealing, especially for those who maybe traveling from one climate to a completely different one for competition? Is there a standardized protocol or anything that we can do in a short period of time that will really help us improve our performance in the heat?
Yeah. I mean, in terms of the short, easy things, I mean, some of the pre-cooling stuff might work. You know, people could experiment with that. I wouldn't throw too much money at it. But this is an interesting one because I think I've seen it around for a while at like different conferences and things like that. And I think a lot of the research is around strength training and lifting, which is interesting in itself. I don't look in that space very much, so I'm not real familiar with how the mechanism would work there. I could theoretically see some of the benefits for it with endurance athletes, but again, getting into the trade-offs of things. So first of all, it's only going to probably benefit while you're using it. And so if we're talking about a bike, then you're going to have to just put all that weight of that cooling device on the bike. And probably it was just, what are we going to do? Have it in the handlebars or something like that? I mean, maybe if you can get it on the bike below and still be below the UCI limit.
Yeah, but these are like huge mitts. Like they're massive, right? Like they have to weigh like a kilo or two each mitt.
Yeah. You know, maybe there's some kind of pre-cooling effect. You could have that on during your warm up. I don't know. It's one of those things where you'd want to see research on it. I'd have to look into it, see what's going on there, to see what kind of benefit it was. I would definitely say before anyone would buy this to like look up and see if there's any research on it, because we can sit and reason conclusions about a lot of things, but doesn't mean we're reasoning the correct conclusion. So I would definitely want to see some good data on how it works within a hot environment. I doubt it would have a great effect in an environment that's where you're already, you know, it's cool, right? From room temperature and lower down to 10 degrees or, you know, 10 degrees Celsius.
Well, what about the other thing? Like there's this, some guy took Craig Heller's research. I think there is a paper from Stanford so this other guy took Craig's research and he made this PVC pipe stick that you put cold water into. And, you know, they say if you hold on to that thing for 3 minutes while doing exercise, it will, you know, drastically reduce your core temperature and help you thermoregulate. Does that idea sound like there could be any validity to it at all?
All right. Well, acutely, yes, it could. And I would be, like I said, I'd look at the data, just want to look at the data to see how it goes. And then, but again, there's a few things that are going to be interesting, I guess, or could conflate those results or could interfere with the results in the real world with endurance athletes, potentially. One of them is if they're doing this with strength-trained athletes or with sedentary athletes or fit people who, and then getting back to that ability to thermoregulate just from doing consistent endurance training, maybe it wouldn't have as much of an effect on an endurance athlete. Maybe. Because maybe they already have whatever benefits that this wouldn't offset enough.
That's a good point. And I think that sweat rate comment you made, like that probably is a differentiator in a lot of these things that we see out there. Because I mean, in this particular study from Craig, it's like he was able to show 300% performance increase in some guy's ability to do, you know, dips, which is an exercise where you use primarily your chest and tricep muscles, for anybody that doesn't know. But there's no way anybody in road cycling is going to get 300% increase in anything.
No. But they could, you know, they could just as easily argue that it's just going to be an additive effect or helpful effect with what the endurance athlete already does. But we would need research to say either way. But here's something that is really interesting, I think, when it comes down to talking about cooling and heat, Well, if I wanted you to jump as high as you possibly could, right? I would take you to the moon because you would be able to jump higher there because there's a lack of gravity, right?
Do you have a rocket? Can we?
I mean, you know, me and Elon Musk, we're best bros, so we'll, you know. How are you looking for next Thursday?
I'm available. If we're going to the moon, Elon, dude?
Yeah. But if I leave you on the moon, your ability to jump on Earth is going to get, like, attenuated pretty quickly.
Right? Okay, I see where you're going with this.
Right? And so I wrote an article for Cycling Tips a few years ago. It was called Can You Temperature Dope?
Right.
And it was talking about, because in the virtual cycling space, you get to choose what environment that you ride in, right? So if you're racing and you want a little bit of a legal bump, like, you could reduce the temperature that you're racing in and put a big fan on you to improve the convection and that type of thing. And that could help your performance. Now, however, potentially if you do that all the time, then your body could potentially lose the adaptations that it would get from being under thermal stress.
Right.
And interestingly enough, we did see something that kind of hinted towards that in the research and the training study that I did. So these athletes only were exposed to 13 degrees Celsius during 8 interval sessions over the course of 3 weeks or 4 weeks, twice a week. And we saw almost, like, it couldn't get any closer, honestly, almost a significant decrease in gross mechanical efficiency in that group. What is going on? And during their time trials, even though there was no difference in the performance outcomes, although, I mean, there was differences in the effect size, even though there was no difference in the performance outcomes in 22 degrees of Celsius time trials, we still saw, like, increased heart rates, significantly increased heart rates and RPE in that 13 degree group. So is there something going on there with that cold exposure causing, you know, decreases in probably skin adaptation or sweating or something like that, that would have this kind of negative effect on thermal regulation? Because you can see adaptations in the skin for cold, even if you are exercising, which was getting back to the earlier before. It gets complicated. So, just under that principle of, like, if you remove the stress, like, great, it's going to be good for that one off, but you probably want to be kind of careful about how often you do it, right?
Right.
So that you would actually get that response. So when it comes to that device, there's probably a lot of other things that cyclists could probably focus on before that. On our podcast with the Cycling Performance Club, we always have, thought experiment, where you have this guy with unlimited funds. Sure, yeah, let's try it, see how it goes. Right. But most people don't have an unlimited funds, so yeah, maybe I would definitely say let's wait until we have a good body of research out there to support it, and then figure out how you're really going to apply it in the real world.
All right, so now that we've just completed Dr. Boynton's crash course on high-performance activity for cyclists in heat, let's talk about the other end of the spectrum.
Okay.
Let's talk about the cold. Cyclocross season is coming up for the entire world, and I know we've got a lot of Canadian listeners. Shout out to everyone that came up to me at national championships this year and mentioned the pod. You guys rock. What are some of the effects of cold weather that we should consider when we look at training or competing in colder conditions?
I wrote a few articles for Training Pigs. I don't know, it might have been like 10 years ago. And when I went through that, I kind of made the argument that you could come from a hot environment like Texas or something like that and race. At that time, we had the national cyclocross championships in Wisconsin in like January. So it's super cold.
Yeah.
And I made the argument that you probably wouldn't need to worry about cold acclimation because it's not like heat. But now, you know, that I've gone through a PhD looking at thermal regulation, I'm not quite as sure. Like, I think there's potentially some benefits, but yeah. We'll get into that in a second. But I think the important thing is, like, acutely on the day, I would say you'd really want to avoid any kind of drop in your core temperature. Now, obviously, not most people aren't going to get a rectal thermometer and watch their core temp before they come into the cyclocross race for that day. But speaking of Canada, there's some research that came out of Stephen Chung's lab in Canada that I'm basing this opinion on. And basically what they did was they dropped cyclists' temperature, core temperature, by like half a degree. And then they had them perform time trials at 0 degrees Celsius, self-paced time trials. And they found that it was significantly reduced the power output compared to time trials in 23 degrees Celsius. But, you know, opposite of that, this is off memory. I believe there's other research out there that has shown that warm-ups really don't have an effect on performing in a cold environment. So what's the difference here? Well, if I recall correctly, I don't think that the warm-up studies were dropping the core temperatures of the athletes. They were just kind of coming in with or without warm-ups as their core temperature set, right, at normal core temperature levels. So in my mind, in a real world setting at a cold cyclocross race, I think warm-ups are really important because you expose yourself to cold while you've gotten out of the car and done your sign up and your registration and all that kind of stuff. I think the warm-up is important to have to kind of negate and attenuate any of the decreases in core temperature that you may have experienced while you were in that environment, right? So I think it's important to dress appropriately before races and things like that. So that's the things that you can do on the day to help your performance in the cold. I think cold acclimation, I mean, if you really want, like, these protocols that you see in the literature for cold acclimation are crazy. 4 weeks of, you know, sitting in 10 degrees Celsius, 50 degrees Fahrenheit rooms for like an hour and a half a day, like to get. So, and that, I don't know if you'd necessarily have to get to that point, but yeah, it's a big cost. So
where do you find that room? Where does that exist?
Yeah, exactly. So I would lean a little bit more towards cold acclimatization because it's just going to happen naturally. Most people who are racing cyclocross are going to be training in the environment that they're going to race in. And most people who are amateurs are probably training at night or in the morning when it's already kind of cool. So, yeah, I guess the other thing is it comes down to behavioral adaptations. And so we talk about dressing, I think, is really important in cyclocross. For example, I think like people get these long sleeve skin suits and they're like, oh, I've got the sweet long sleeve skin suit and the bike slides up and down. It's oh so nice while I'm, you know, doing my carries and everything like that. But man, if you're using that skin suit in September when it's 22 degrees out, you're just frying yourself. Like it's silly. But I think one of the things that we overlook when we ride in the cold is our ability to overdress. And I've made this argument with, say, like Australian riders that leave the hot summer and then come to the cold environment here or here, but in Europe, well, if you come down to there, it comes down to microclimate. Like, what kind of climate have you trapped against your skin? And if you're used to riding at 35, 40 degrees Celsius for all your summer, and then you've just kind of, that's normal for you, and then you come into a cold bike race, maybe part of the problem is like, yeah, you probably don't handle the cold very well before the race, which incidentally, shivering is something like 1,000 watts or something like that. It's insane how energy hungry shivering is.
Yeah, and it's very fascinating.
And it's apparently very carbohydrate hungry too.
Wow.
So avoid shivering, avoid that drop in core temperature. But also at the same time, you want to use the environment to your advantage. So you don't want to overheat. You don't want to get into a situation that you bundled up. And then once you've that intensity, that high intensity of the cyclocross races come into play, and now you've warmed up, you either want to the ability to kind of to you know, it's hard to do anything in a race except for concentrate on that race, especially something like cyclocross. So, you know, I used to never use a long sleeve skin suit. I'd always have one that with arm warmers because they were super easy just to peel off if I started getting too hot. But yeah, you kind of want to be thinking about how to do that thermal regulation. And I guess one of the things that I tell my athletes that are cyclocross racers to kind of help them with their thermal regulation is it just like kind of, you know, a rule of thumb is if it's cold out and I can see your number before the race, then you're doing it wrong. And there's two reasons for that. Like, either you are underdressed, while you're warm up, doing the warm up and scouting out the course and things like that, because you are doing all of those things at a lower intensity than what you would do in the race. Therefore, there's maybe a good chance that core temperature would drop. Or on the other side of it, you've got some kind of winter jacket on or multiple base layers, and you're very comfortable at where you're at with that number pinned on. And then as soon as you get into that high intensity cyclocross race, now you're going to overheat. So that's always my thing. If I was walking around at the cyclocross race and my athletes were there, I'm like, I could see your number. What are you, you know, what is your strategy for thermal regulation here? So I don't know if you have any thoughts on that, but that's just something to kind of help. Like, a lot of times, you know, we take the science and it has to be distilled down to something that is kind of a take home thing. And that's kind of like one of my go-to for thermal regulation in cyclocross races, in my opinion.
So don't shiver.
Avoid shivering.
Strip down before your race, and trust your body's ability to produce heat. What else? Was there another takeaway from that?
I mean, avoid, like, dress warm. Get it. Oh, yeah. The other thing is time management. Get there early. Get it. Bring a trainer, because the trainer is going to force you to sit there and force you to warm up. It's going to have less convection. It's going to have a less, more effective ability for you to warm up. And then also make sure that part of your warm up is scouting the course, which isn't necessarily a thermoregulatory thing, but it all matches into, like, yeah, let's see how late you can get your warm up in and that kind of stuff. And, you know, obviously be concerned about how much you're sweating, because, man, like, you get a bunch of sweat on you and you're going to get very cold very quickly, right?
Oh, that's a whole nother factor too. I always, you know, I live in a very mountainous city, and if it's kind of like a medium temperature day, which for here is like 20 degrees Celsius or 21 degrees Celsius in the city, and you know you're about to go up 1,000 meters, you actually want to open your jersey a little bit on the climb so that you're not sweating, because you know if you get to the top and you're soaked, you're going to be freezing cold.
Freezing on the descent, yep.
Yeah. Well, it's just that where I live, you're either training, you know, at 1,500 meters or over 2,000. And so the difference in temperature is about 10 degrees Celsius usually up there. It's usually about 10 degrees colder. So it's, yeah, if you get up there soaked, you're freezing. So don't make that mistake, folks. So what do you think about some of these products like heat rub and warm-up creams and things of that nature? Is there any benefit there?
They're horrible.
Concise.
They're horrible. And I think the people that are selling them are snake oil salesmen. How's that for controversy?
Yeah, like, I mean, it's pretty controversial, but why? I mean, I tend to agree with you, but
yeah,
you could probably explain it better than most people. Why do you feel so strongly
story,
about it?
Yeah, so funny story is that like had Bloomberg reporter from Bloomberg Business contacted me like a few years ago because they wanted a source for an article because I guess women in New York were using these creams so during the winter so they could wear like short skirts or something like that. And
what?
The journalist the only person they could find that was talking negatively about these creams was apparently me. Like she found one of my articles again. It had a multiple part series on cyclocross racing and Training Peaks, and that was one of the things I kind of really dished on and why it doesn't make any sense. But first of all, like the person, like we have to start out with an epistemological base here, is that the person making the claim, i.e. the person selling the product, is the person who has to come up with the evidence that their claim is truthful. Right? I don't have to come up with the research for this. They should be coming up with a third party researcher that's, you know, not influenced by them or there's papers that they should be able to point to. We don't have to just take their word for it. That's silly. And anyways, so to start out from there, how it works is they always advertise, it's funny too, because they advertise it as this contains capsicum, which in Australia, I could imagine that wouldn't help sales because capsicum is just their word for peppers. Like, do you want capsicum on your 12-inch Subway sub, right? Like, so they take basically the word pepper, what we call peppers, change it into capsicum, and you're basically rubbing that on your skin. And that somehow that molecule interacts with our thermal sensors. So it's not an increase in temperature. We have the sensation of an increase in temperature. Now, you could argue maybe it irritates the skin and that brings more blood to the surface. But what were we just talking about with decreases in performance and bringing more blood to the surface?
Right.
It's not like, I'm not saying that it will decrease performance, but I am saying, well, why would we want that?
And would it maybe disrupt your sweat efficiency?
I have no idea, but I do have kind of a very kind of funny kind of thought experiment, very Colby Pierce-esque. So imagine Zach, you are at Buffalo Wild Wings or something like that, and you're chowing down on spicy wings, down on some beers, and then you have to go to the bathroom, right? You go to the bathroom, you forgot to wash your hands before you started to the bathroom.
Where are you going with this?
And then all of a sudden, you're like, I have a very warm sensation. Now, is that warm sensation because your hands are any warmer when you are touching sensitive skin? No, it has nothing to do with that. It has to do with you are getting a false sense of warmth because there is a chemical that is stimulating your thermal sensors, right? So that is the thing, like, that people, I think, will get because it's the same thing that you find that would makes the spice in food is the same thing that makes that heat sensation on your skin. And so, yeah, there's that connection. It's just that.
right? It's just that, but on your legs. So is that really going to improve your performance? I highly doubt it. It makes no sense to me. And I think it has potentially detrimental effects. In one, you're bringing skin blood to the skin where it doesn't need to be. But that is, again, like just my own reasoned conclusion. And again, I'm making the claim on that, and I don't have a study to point to. I'm just saying this is a caveat. It's a caution. However, it also people wouldn't be wearing knee warmers and things like that and covering their knees. And that is something I'm a little bit more concerned about. And about, because that really stores heat around the muscle. And things like the knee doesn't have a lot of adipose tissue around it. It doesn't have a lot of vasculature around it. So it loses heat, and it's at the front of the bike. So it's getting a lot of convection over it, and it's moving, and it's a connective tissue that you want to keep warm so that you don't injure it. And there's maybe an argument that it increases economy by keeping that knee nice and warm and not cool. So lots of reasoning and rationalization to get to my point, but they don't have any studies either. So, and again, they're making the claim that this is an important performance improver, then where's their research? And not only that, but where's their research without that, you know, would have a good, how do you counter the placebo effect of that too?
Right.
Right. You have to have something in there. But anyways, yeah, those are my thoughts. I think it's silly. It's just, yeah, just one of those weird places where tradition takes over any kind of common sense, I think.
Fair point. Well thought out. I agree with you. I've had nothing but negative experiences with those. I mean, I get it all the time in my DMs. People are like, dude, I got this cream. It's going to make you go ballistic. This is how it works. It's magic. And I've tried a couple of them and just had the same experience. Like, dude, there's nothing positive coming out of this leg rub, you know? So I tend to absolutely agree with you. While this podcast has been eye-opening for me on many levels, and I hope that our listeners have learned an incredible amount from this show. Unfortunately, that's all we have time for today. Thank you all so much for spending the time with us on this episode of the Team EF Coaching Performance Podcast. Don't forget to like the episode, mark it as a favorite, or share it with a friend. Dr. Jason Boynton, thank you so much for joining us today. I'm Zach Morris from Team EF Coaching, and this is the Team EF Coaching Performance Podcast. Until next time, take care, everyone.
Yeah, thanks for having me.